Okay, another time for questions. For those of you who rushed off to the toilet, I'll try and speak loudly so you can hear them in the toilet. So here we go, the first fun and games this evening. Ajahn, can I please ask you a question on the second tetrad of Anapanasati? Yes, you can. Next question. So they are. Okay, I don't know what you want to know about the second tetrad of Anapanasati, but basically it is you develop the happiness and the joy, the pity and the sukha. Now sometimes some people, they try and make a distinction between the pity and the sukha, and they get into arguments about which one is which, but you don't need to worry about that at this particular stage, because it's only when the difference between the second and the third jhana, that's when you really see it as an experience. Because usually pity, sukha are like two inseparable twins. They always hang out together, that really you only see them together, so you can't really tell which one is which. Until the time comes when you move from a second to the third jhana, one of those twins disappears. It's the pity which disappears when you move from the second to the third jhana. And then, only then, when you've just got sukha by itself, you know really from experience what sukha is. And then, by inference, you know, what's missing was the pity part. Strange thing, but that's the only time you can really understand what those two things really are. And you can read, some people say it's this, some people say it's that, but you don't really need to be concerned. It's just the happiness and the joy which is coming from the meditation. And there's many types of happiness and joy during the interviews that sometimes we talk about crying with joy. That's a type of piti sukha, but it's nice, it's wonderful when you're sort of listening to a Dharma talk or you're going to the places in India or you're reflecting on your goodness or whatever. But it is a bit of a distracting type of piti sukha, just the really powerful happiness is which makes you sometimes cry with joy or shake with happiness. But when you're actually developing this, you have to find out that it's a type of piti sukha which you can hold and maintain for a long time. That's why it's more like the delightful, the this is so nice, rather than the very strong and agitating piti sukha. But after a while, when you become a monk, you get to know what pleasure is, and you become a connoisseur of the higher pleasures of life as a monk or a nun. Sometimes people think, you're a monk, what do you know about pleasures of life? Aha, we know more than the average Joe or Joanne, because we go into the pleasures of the mind and you really become an expert on what pleasure is. So as you go deeper into the meditation, you understand what is that type of pleasure which comes up, you know, during that the fifth and sixth days, the beginning of the second tetrad. And that type of happiness and joy, you know, I'd called it first of all the beautiful breath, but sometimes that was a bit too visual for many people, so sometimes people prefer the delightful breath. And it's a sort of happiness when you're just so at ease, just watching the breath go in, the breath go out, or just this moment of breath now, whatever you're watching, but it's just so nice, you just don't want to go anywhere, you're just perfectly content where you are. And it's the sort of happiness where you're just happy, just meditating backwards and forwards. You don't have to struggle and strive like most people normally do. You know, just, I've got to get onto the bed, it's not working, a thought here, there's trouble there, and an itch there, an ache there. So it's a sense of like relief. You're really at peace, you're in a nice meditation, and it's effortless. Now that's the type of like piti sukha of that fifth and sixth stage. And like the effortless ability to watch the breath because you're enjoying it. It's fun. Now, after a while, people can actually see that happiness. One of the important types of focusing which helps with that, developing that piti sukha of the fifth and sixth stage of Anapanasati, is suppressing the fault-finding mind and developing the gratitude, positive, looking for fun type of mind. Now, what we mean there is, this is one of the problems with especially modern Western people. We have been trained to see what's wrong in things. So even when you come to the retreat, it's what's wrong with your room, what's wrong with your cushion, what's wrong with the food, what's wrong with the walls, what's wrong with the aircon, what's wrong with everything. And you know that we can become very critical as human beings. And sometimes that's taken for granted in our world, because that's all we have to do to get on in life. However, when actually you're doing some meditation, that really is a big hindrance, that critical mind. Because that stops the happiness and joy arising. Instead we have this beautiful accepting mind, this loving, this non-critical, what I said this morning, the non-judgmental mind. And if anything, we look for the beauty, the joy, the happiness in things. So we're actually out there not looking to find fault with somebody, but to see just what a wonderful person that is sitting next to you, that they've actually come on this retreat, and they may not be in jhana yet, but it's wonderful, they're giving up these 9 days to do something really, really worthwhile. You may not like the food today, but somebody actually spent such a long time trying to do their very, very best to cook that food. You may not like my jokes, but I'm really trying hard the very, very best I can to tell them to make you happy. So instead of being fault-finding, you have this wonderful appreciation. It's actually we see the beauty and the positive side of things. Now when you do that, when you get that sort of sense of breath is becoming nice and smooth, that ability to see the positive in it, the joy in it, which you train yourself in life with some positive thinking and positive looking and positive hearing, that means that you can see beauty much quicker. So when the breath starts to become peaceful, you can realize this is nice, this is beautiful, this is delightful. You see the joy earlier when you develop that type of mind. And also you do live a happier life outside of meditation too. Positive people can get to that fifth and sixth stage of Anapanasati much quicker than negative guys and girls. So that helps to get to that stage. And when it's really there, you've got this beautiful piece of meditation. You just stay there. Like everything else, the main reason why that happiness is there is the happiness born of something being still. You know, you've made the mind focus on one thing, you haven't been thinking about this and that and moving the mind backwards and forwards, which means it's being still. The opposite of that is what we call the monkey mind. And if you want to know what the monkey mind is, a couple of retreats ago, a person told me a story, and it's one of the lovely examples of what a monkey mind is by telling you a story. And as a Sri Lankan man told me the story, so this monkey mind story begins in Sri Lanka. On a Poya day. A Poya day is the day when many of the lay people all go to the temple, you know, to listen to the Dharma, to keep the precepts and offer food to the monks. So it's one of the Poya days, and lots of people were going to the temple to offer food to the monks. And also going on a Poya day was a monkey. Now he wasn't going there to receive the precepts. He was seeing if he could steal anything, because there was lots of food around on those days. So the monkey went into the temple looking for someone who dropped a banana or some leftover somewhere to see if he gets something to eat. And as he was swinging around in the trees, he came close to the hall, and there he heard the priest giving a talk. And he heard the subject of the sermon was the monkey mind. And he said, "Oh, this is interesting, you're talking about me, I'm a monkey. So, you know, this is relevant." So, you know, he went to listen. What do they mean by this monkey mind? And he heard this priest say, "The monkey mind is a bad mind. You know, it's the sort of mind only stupid people have, and you've got to get rid of this monkey mind, because monkey mind is bad, and it's restless, it stops you becoming still and peaceful and enlightened and everything. Monkey mind is something you just don't want to have anything to do with." And that monkey was very offended. "What's wrong with monkey minds? You know, I'm a monkey, you just don't know what you're talking about. Monkey minds are fun. And you've just been abusing us. If I could find a lawyer, I would sue you, monk, for the way you offend a monkey mind." He was so upset, he swang back into where he lived in the forest and told all the other monkeys about what people say about monkeys in the monastery. And of all places, they thought they'd get some respect and some compassion was in the temple. But no, monkeys were bad, especially because they had monkey minds. And all the other monkeys, they really got upset, and they started jumping up and down. Down with the monks. They should say that we should do something. It's wrong to sort of abuse and offend and curse monkeys for having a monkey mind. And the leader of them saw all these monkeys protesting, jumping up and down, getting more and more irate, and he said, stop it. You see, they're right. That is a monkey mind, jumping up and down, complaining and being so restless. And all the monkeys said, hey, you're right. Because monkey minds, when you're wandering all over the place, jumping from one thing to another, getting really upset, that's called monkey mind. And the poor monkeys got all depressed. Oh, isn't this terrible? We've been born with a monkey mind. We're never getting enlightened. So what can we do about this? And the head monkey, you know, he'd been around for a long time, and he said, well, look, you know, I've been to that temple. I've heard about sort of that monkey mind myself a long time ago, and I've heard how you overcome the monkey mind. What you have to do is to meditate. And all the monkeys say, yeah, that's a good idea, let's meditate. They're jumping up and down, yeah, we'll meditate. That's not how you meditate. Sit down, monkeys. And the head monkey taught all the little monkeys how to meditate. He said, now, first of all, you've got to sit down on a nice soft cushion. So they all went down to get some grass here, some leaves over there to make themselves nice saffos. Now what do we do? Okay, then you sit down, cross your legs, they all cross their legs. Right, left paw first, right paw on top of the left paw. Get your back straight, and they all got their back straight, heads down, and watch your breath go in and out. So all the monkeys were doing anapanasati, watching their breath go in, watching their breath go out, breath go in, breath go out. Only lasted about 2 minutes. And then one of the monkeys put their paw up, excuse me, he said. And everyone was, you know, waiting for someone to say that so they could open their eyes, because they were getting really bored out of their skulls too. What do you want? And he said, look, don't you remember that we were going to go to the local banana plantation to raid it for lunch? Remember that was our plan? We said about this morning? No, I've been meditating and wondering, but I keep thinking about we've got to go to the banana plantation. It gets restless. I'm going to think about the future. So look, why don't we all go to the banana plantation first of all and raid it, get all the bananas. We won't eat it yet because it's not lunchtime. We'll just get them first of all. Now get it out of the way first of all, because then we can meditate. All right, yeah, good idea. So they all decided to go to the banana plantation first, to get that out of the way, so they didn't have to worry about it. They could meditate without all these problems. So off they went, they swam to the banana plantation, they stole a lot of bananas, heaps of them. But they didn't eat any. They all went back to where they lived in the forest and made a big pile of bananas, right in the middle, so that when they finished their meditation, they could have the lunch. It was all there for them. So then they all sat down, cross-legged, right paw over the left paw, back straight, heads down, breathing in and breathing out. 2 minutes later, a paw went up. Excuse me, I've been thinking, you know, that before we eat those bananas, we have to peel them. Why don't we get it out of the way, first of all? So we won't have to worry about it. And I'm like, yeah, it's good, we won't eat any, okay, because it's not lunchtime yet. So you're going to be worrying about this. And once you get all your worries out of the way, then you can meditate. So they all went, sort of peeling their bananas, and they put a big pile of ready-peeled bananas. And they all went back to where they sat, you know, down on the cushions, right paw over the left paw, heads down, back straight, watching their breath, breathing in, breathing out. You can imagine the smell of freshly peeled bananas. 1 minute, monkey put his paw up and said, excuse me, I've just been thinking. You know, before we eat those bananas, there's one thing we have to do, which is put them in our mouth. Why don't you put them in our mouth, first of all? We won't eat them. Get it out of the way, and then we can meditate. And all of them like, great idea. So they all grab a couple of bananas each, stuff them in their mouth. Always 2 or 3 monkeys have 4 bananas in their mouth. It's amazing how many bananas you can stuff in your mouth. They didn't eat them. They sat there with bananas in their mouth, straight back, right paw over left paw, head down, breathing in, breathing out. And of course, while everyone had their eyes closed, they ate all the bananas. And by the time they finished eating the bananas, the end of the meditation was over. And they hadn't done any meditation at all. They were saying, that's what's called the monkey mind. Getting things out of the way, first of all. And I was telling a couple of people here that last retreat, I don't know if it was the last retreat, or 1 year ago here. when it got to Saturday morning, the Saturday morning talk, the last day of the retreat, I told all the meditators here, put your hand up if you've already packed your bags. And then about half the people put their hand up and said, what are you packing your bags for? It hasn't ended yet. You've got another day and a bit to go. It's only Saturday morning. We don't finish till 3 p.m. So you're like those monkeys. Let's get it out of the way. Then we can meditate. So on this retreat, you don't pack your bags until after lunch at the earliest. I don't mean lunch today. I mean lunch on Saturday. Why is it people are packing their bags and they've still got lots of time to go yet? You can see your monkey mind. So people who have that monkey mind, they can't stay in the present moment. They can't get any happiness. But when you're actually in this beautiful, lovely, delightful state, then you're very peaceful and happy. You just watch the breath, no problem at all. You don't even think about bananas or lunch or packing your bags. And that's that important fifth and sixth stage in breath meditation. If you develop that, it comes from the stillness. Eventually the stillness means more mindfulness, so you can see deep, you can actually see the breath, see it all. Because your mindfulness has increased. And it's also, you can see its beauty. Which means you get this wonderful, beautiful, happy state of mind. And you just stay there, which is the third of that second tetrad. Actually you feel the whole thing, then you calm it down, the fourth. Just the stillness calms the happiness and joy. It calms and gets more and more still and more powerful. As it gets more powerful, then it just transforms into the next stage, which is the nimitta coming up. The nimitta comes up when the mind is so powerful, because of you being very still, the happiness and joy has allowed you to be still. The happiness and joy, the piti sukha, has been the glue which has stuck your attention onto the breath. Which means you can be more and more still, less effort to allow the mind image to come up in stage number 9. Then you go on to the next tetrad. So that's how it all happens. Quite natural. But just to get to the happiness and joy stage, I always call that the pivot point, the springboard, because it's from there you really get into the nice meditations. When you get the delightful breath, then you're on your way. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah? Yeah? Well, you can ask one. Get your most important question of the second tetrad. You've got to be quick. Yeah.
And what happened was the smile energy just took over and sort of spot on a direction by itself.
Very good, because yeah, go.
My question to you is, at that point, should I go with that energy rather than forget about the awareness of the in-breath and the out-breath?
Very good question. Very good question. When you get to that stage, the in and out breath has gone in, you're very easy to watch the in and out breath, but then so the joy comes in and the joy becomes the dominant. That is what's supposed to happen. The first four stages, your main object is your breath, which is why it is called like part of the body contemplation. in the Anapanasati. I mentioned earlier the breath meditation fulfills the four Satipatthanas. The first tetrad fulfills the first Satipatthana on the body concentration. The second tetrad fulfills the Vedana, the feeling or sensation tetrad. Because that's, you know, it's pointing out to you very clear the way the Buddha taught this, that when you get to that last, second tetrad, you're not really watching the breath anymore. You're watching the joy, the feeling, the happiness of the breath. It's the joy and the happiness becomes your main focus. So, you know, you may have like some your food over there, but it's the taste of the food. That's the delicious part of it. That is the aspect which you're focusing on. So you may think, oh yeah, I'm still sort of aware of the breath, but it's the joy of the breath which is the dominant one feature. And it's the joy which takes over until by the end of that first tetrad you're just watching joy and happiness. So forget about the breath. The breath has done its job. There is a simile in the Samanyapala Sutta, the second sutra of the Digha Nikaya, of King Ajatasattu. Once he bumped off his father and took over the throne, he went to see the Buddha in the bamboo grove. And they say he went in a chariot as far as a chariot could go. Then he got out of the chariot and walked as far as he could walk. And then he had to take off his shoes when he went into the hall where the Buddha was living or staying. In the same way that your breath can only take you so far. It's like a chariot. And then you've got to leave your breath behind. And you use the joy and happiness, which takes you closer to the hall where the Buddha is. And then you've got to take off your shoes. In other words, let the joy go and just go to the nimitta, the beautiful mind. But it's the joy still there as well. You've still got your legs. But you use different vehicles at different times. Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay, when the joy sort of doesn't relate to the breath, it means that the breath, there's a bit of expectation, there is a usual problem, there is something stopping the breath becoming so calm and still that the breath sort of held the joy. It's the same way that when already some people have got some nice meditations going, they go out and see the flowers or they see the grass or they look at the carpet and it looks beautiful. Is the carpet beautiful? Is the breath beautiful? Actually, the breath is just the breath. But it's what's happening here. The mind gets powered up. And because of the power of the mindfulness, because there's enough stillness, no expectation, nothing to sort of wobble the mind, the stillness is what is really the source of the joy, you see. So, you can smile. The smile is almost like a shortcut. Loving kindness is a little trick to advance the process. But the main cause of that happiness is the mind is becoming still and the mindfulness is increasing. If that was happening late at night, it may just be your mindfulness was really weak and you did need to go to bed because your mindfulness wasn't strong enough to see the beauty. Or it was agitated. You were agitating it somewhere, so it couldn't stay still long enough to get the happiness up. But stillness is the main cause of the happiness. And it's a wonderful actually thing to realize that. That's one of the great insights. If you can see that and understand it, how the happiness of the mind is caused from stillness. You learn how to keep that mind still. You have a source of joy, of happiness, any time you want. So energize you, create strong mindfulness, strong happiness, and it's just there for you anytime. Okay, now we have some long questions. Ajahn, why does the Sangha at Bodhinyana still cling to the rules and rituals of the motherland of Thailand? Rules and rituals referred to are having to be seated when drinking, shaving off eyebrows, receiving offerings from women through a piece of cloth, novices not being allowed to wear outer robe, not ordaining bhikkhunis during the last 2 decades for fear of upsetting the Thai Sangha's higher authority, the popes of Thai Buddhism, and then being excommunicated from the Thai Sangha connection, using the Thai name Ajahn for senior monks. These rules and rituals were not laid down by the Buddha, so why Does the Sangha still hang on to such rules and rituals since that the monasteries in Australia? And the main answer is just for a peaceful life. Because whenever you do sort of reforms, then there's always trouble. People come over and, you know, some conservative monks tell you off, and then some monks come from Thailand and give you a hard time, or you go off to Thailand and you get a hard time. But anyway, having to be seated when drinking, I don't always sit down when I'm drinking, because sometimes, one of the things you have to do in my position is sometimes you go to these functions. You know, sometimes, you know, before the function, before everyone is sitting down, they give you a glass of orange juice. They've tried to give me wine before, but I'm very good at that. That's not sort of Thai Buddhism, that's actually Buddhism. So they take, you know, the glass of orange juice and you talk to people while you're standing. There's nothing wrong with that. That is actually just Thai custom, nothing in the vineyard there. So you can stand when you're drinking, but not alcohol, obviously. And shaving off eyebrows. You know why the shaving off eyebrows came? Because that was because when the Burmese invaded Thailand, they thought that many of those Burmese monks, they weren't real monks, they were spies. To check out the Thai kingdom. And so they were going to check them out and then report back to the generals so they could actually get into the city and do everything. So, because of the paranoia of the Thai government at the time, they said, okay, all monks in Thailand, shave off your eyebrows so we can tell who are our monks and who are their monks. And that's actually where it started from and just carried on since then. But it's just a small thing. You know, why not? It makes it much easier when you go back to Thailand. And so what? It's a big deal. Maybe I should try the middle way, just shave off one eyebrow and see the other way. But it's just for an easy life. Receiving offerings from women through a piece of cloth. In Thailand I do that. You may have noticed here I don't. So when I'm in Thailand I do it the Thai way. When I'm in Australia, the Australian way. When I'm in Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan way. So, for example, when I'm on the aircraft, I do it the Qantas way. So we don't actually cling to these. Novice is not being allowed to wear the outer robe. And the outer robe is actually the symbol of a monk. And if a novice wore the outer robe, the thing which goes on the outside, then people would think they were monks. And it would confuse people and confuse them as well. And they could still wear something else on the inside or the outside. They still keep warm. So it's not a big deal. Not our daily bhikkhunis. Okay, we're changing that one. For the fear of upsetting the Thai Sangha's high authority. You don't upset people when you don't really need to. And there's other ways of doing things. And Buddhism has always been like wise and compassionate and subtle. Not in your face. This is wrong. I'm going to just do it. Because that sort of upsets and angers people. And it's very insensitive, you know, to other cultures. So I know that that has caused a lot of problems. That insensitivity. We all want to do the right thing. But if you do it the wrong way. There is one example of that. There was some trouble many years ago with the visas for monks over in Thailand, for Western monks. And it got very, very difficult for a while. And one of these novice monks, he was from America, he jumped up and down, made a big furore and said, "You can't do this to us. This is not the right way of doing things." And we tried to stop this guy, but he just made things even more difficult for us. And said, "Look, you don't know how things are done. You've got the right intention there, you know, to make things easier, but you don't do it that way. You know, you have to be sensitive to the different cultures of the world. And you all know Asian culture means saving face, not embarrassing anybody. So you don't go up there and just do the bhikkhuni ordination right in the face, you know, of the Sangha Raja of Thailand and say, you know, up yours, mate, as they say in Australia." That's ridiculous. So you do it in the right way. And the right way is actually, you know, as they say, you know, to win the hearts and minds, the sort of thing which George Bush didn't do. To get people on side. And when you get people on side, you do it right, you do it, get all your preparation done. Because it was a lot of preparation, actually, to, now how do you ordain bhikkhunis? Now what is actually the difficulties, what are the solutions? You know, there's been many conferences where we've moved forward every time. It's not an easy thing to do. And also, do women want to become bhikkhunis? And that was also a big thing. It's only, I speak for Sister Wayama, but this is how I've been hearing her. A couple of years ago, she wasn't all that interested in becoming a bhikkhuni. And only recently, by going to conferences, by seeing what's actually happening in the world, now she's interested. So things change, so you have to work with that change. So it's not clinging to rules, it's actually being very sensitive, compassionate and wise, and understanding how things are done and how things are done well, rather than just in your face. And using the Thai name Ajahn for senior monks. Well, I don't know, sometimes that we, when Ajahn Chakra was here, we tried to use the word brother. And it lasted about, 6 hours. And it looked so stupid. It felt so stupid. Hello, Brother Santiti. You say, hello, brother. Bro-bram. He's a bro. So in the end, we just said, might as well use Ajahn because that's our tradition. And it makes it easier for us. So it's only a small thing. But sometimes we do use other traditions. It ties us to our roots, but it's not all that much. So basically, unless it's a good reason, then we just might as well keep our tradition. So we usually keep it unless there's a good reason to jettison it. We have jettisoned many things. It depends on the cop flag, yeah, but how much depends on how you do it. So you don't want to do it in your face. And if you don't do it in your face, you do it in the right way, you bring a lot of those monks in Thailand with you. And you make it easier for more women to be ordained as bhikkhunis, but this time in Thailand. So you have a responsibility to do it well, so you're not putting back sort of the ordination in other countries. So it is sensitivity, wisdom, compassion, to do it the right way. Is it possible for you to do 30 minutes guided meditation in the hall once a day so that people can come if they want to? I work so hard already. You've got all of these interviews and these talks and stuff like that. Wow, you're squeezing me dry. If you want to do 30 minutes guided meditation, we've got guided meditation tapes, haven't we? Should have. So you get a guided meditation tape, get your iPod, sit here any time of the day and do your guided meditation. So I have the Cyber Monk. We call it Ajahn iPod to keep the Thai tradition. Okay. Do Ajahn Brahm, when the new Jhana Grove Meditation Center is complete, will there be retreats offered all year round? The reason I ask is because some people really want to come to a retreat, but they always have work-study commitments in Easter and in November. These people will never, ever be able to come to a retreat if they are only ever held during these same periods of the year, every single year. Do you mean that I have to teach retreats every week? Oh, you suck me dry. Now, of course, there'll be retreats at different times of the year. Once it's right next door to our monastery, I can just nip over and teach a retreat. Or some other monks, some other nuns, some lay teachers will teach. So there will be many more retreats when it's your own retreat centre. We don't have to worry about booking it here and booking it there. I know that sometimes, we've got these dates because these basically are the only dates they'll give us. Now, sometimes we try to move these, but no. This is, Buddhist society, these are the dates when we can have them. Sometimes you can book them, other times it's really difficult. So I think, what was it, that we wanted to move one of these retreats, I think it was last November, because it was clashing with, the fourth or fifth global conference on Buddhism in Malaysia. And so you know what happened, if you were here the last November retreat, I had to go off to Malaysia for Saturday and Sunday and come back Sunday night and sort of Monday afternoon start teaching the retreat. And then on Kamavara, taught the first part of it. So it was pretty tiring, just go and teach at a global conference and miss your sleep by travelling overnight and then come and take over the retreat on a Monday. Because they wouldn't move the dates for us. So when it's your own retreat, you can actually move it around and then have it more easy for people. But if you really want to come on a retreat, if it's important, you will always make the time. It's amazing what happens. People love golf. If there's a golf tournament, they just take a few days off work. If there is a cricket match on, the Sri Lankans will always find time to watch the cricket. Whatever happens, if it's something you really want to do, you can always find the time. So sometimes people say, well, I'm busy at that time. If you really want to do the retreat, you'd always find the time. So, usually the retreat period is in the Easter, it's because it's school holidays. So for many people who work as teachers or universities, it's a great time, this time of the year. But, there's always people who can come, can't come. So you just try your very best. And of course, the monks have got commitments as well. I've got things we have to do. So especially during the rain retreat. But anyway, because it's next to our monks' monastery, it will be easier to have more retreats throughout the year. And sometimes what we do, when it's our own retreat centre, you have what's called self-retreats. So self-retreats means, you know, there's no teacher there. You just go off and you've got heaps and heaps of talks. You know, you can go and take out the retreat talks of 2006 or whatever, which whenever you prefer, whatever is your favourite vintage, and just play them to yourself every morning or every afternoon, whenever you want to do that. So it's a self-retreat, so your own schedule, you just stay there, and which means at any time you don't need to sort of arrange for the teacher to be there. Because, I mean, there's all the talks are there, all the questions have been answered, all the jokes have been said. So it's all there, you just need to sort of get it from the tapes. If your good karma standard as here as a human being, having found the Buddhist teachings and attending Najan Brahmita retreat, does that mean that there's a good chance that our next rebirth will be human and that we'll meet the Dharma again? Who knows if your next one will be a human? You're thinking about your next rebirth. Yeah, the retreat hasn't even ended yet. That's really going off into the far future. So the best way is just to become enlightened now. Who knows? You know that the retreat centres might die. This place might be overrun by Muslims and there might not be any Buddhism anymore left in the whole world. So you've got 3 days left. Make the best use of it. And let's see what happens afterwards. But yeah, you've got such good karma. The chances are, if you've been really inclining towards one thing in this life, you'll incline towards it in the next life. It's obvious, because it's like a tendency, an inclination, a love. And you'll be drawn to that in your next life. So sure that if you practice a lot of Buddhism, you go to listen to talks, you hang around with Sangha, you sustain monasteries, of course, that's sort of embedded in you as a sort of a character trait, and those character traits, they do go with you from life to life, your karmic tendencies. So sure that chances are each one of you, if you don't make it in this life, if you don't make it in this retreat, you'll come back to another retreat. Or you come back another life. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned the other night that meditation is a great remedy for depression and anxiety, but only a limited, less complex meditation technique should be used for people who suffer from psychotic illness. Could you please expand on those types of meditation? You have to personalize those types of meditation, so you can't generalize at all. Anyone who's got sort of, not so much psychotic, but schizophrenic tendencies, you've got to really sort of talk to them and just basically hold their hand through many meditations to see how they go. That's why it takes a huge input of time if anyone has got sort of schizophrenic tendencies. That's why usually we say, you know, maybe not to do it, or do it very, very slowly, very gently. And it takes a huge amount of personal coaching. That's why I won't answer that question, because that would be generalizing the question. Basically, you've just got to make sure that sort of grounding in reality-based meditations, like the body, feelings on the body is a good one, walking meditation is a good one. But sort of, you know, going too deep in the mind too quickly when they sort of don't know how to let go of those sounds and those visions inside of them, you know, that would be dangerous. Because sometimes it can enhance sort of their delusions of, you know, what they hear inside or what they see in their mind. And that's a big danger. And also you've got to make sure they, whatever medication they keep on that medication, because that balances their brain chemistry. Whilst always in a full mode of relaxing with nature, sitting on a comfy chair, drinking a cup of hot water that warms the heart, being soothed by the fresh wind, playing with the beautifully heart-shaped leaves, simple joys for free. Then suddenly it just happened. A long gum tree trunk dropped within inches, okay, centimetres for the young audience, near to my head. So now I am one step ahead of your walking mantra for us to practice. I will die, that's for sure. You almost did it. My heart now wears this mantra you mentioned before. I know, but I don't know when. Scary time. When I sit under the big tree, or, of course, why not? Yes. That's your special tree. So especially when the wind is blowing and the branches are about to drop. Is it going to hit your head now? You've only got a few seconds to get into jhanas, otherwise you will die. I don't know. Anyway, Someone else said they were sitting outside getting blissed out with nature, and then that's a bird crapped on their head. But that's just because we're in a Christian monastery. In the China Grove Meditation Monastery, all the birds are all Buddhist birds, so they don't do things like that. No, sometimes that's what happens. But yeah, no, sometimes we're blissing out and those things happen. So reminders of the impermanence of things, but at least they've missed your head, because you're all really protected over here. Dear Ajahn, you used to be called Ajahn Brahma Wangsa, but now you're called Ajahn Brahm. Is there a reason for this, and which one do you prefer to be called? Yeah, I mean, the reason was people found it so hard to say Brahma Wangsa, and it wouldn't fit on the cover of the book, so we called it Brahm instead, because Brahm was more soft and cuddly. So just keep it short. So, you know, many of the monks have got nicknames, but I won't tell you them all because they might be embarrassed. The young chanting boy was a reincarnation from 1500 years earlier. Is this a normal turn around time? How and where is this time spent? Is there any way to investigate our own past lives? Yeah, I think that sometimes when people die, especially if they've been like, you know, good monks, good nuns, good meditation practices, you know, really kind, generous people, lots of good karma, they go into heaven realm. And as it says in the teachings of the Buddha, and I've got no reason to doubt this, even the lowest heaven realm, one day of life in the lowest heaven realm is equivalent to 100 years of human life. So in other words, they go up there just for a day, and 100 years of human life has passed. So they come down and have a look after they've had a day in heaven, and it's all changed. All their relations have gone. So that would be 15 days. For that little fellow, not that long, just a couple of weeks holiday in heaven, and back down to earth again. So sometimes that happens. I know that that's why that many of you who go on these pilgrimages, you know, to India, and you go to some of these holy sites, and you feel immense energy in these places. And is it in the stones? Where does that energy come from? I know it's true that people do weep in those places, unexpectedly. You know, these are Westerners who've got little faith, you know, before they go there, but they've got huge amounts of inspiration afterwards. And it's mainly because for some of those heavenly beings, even in those, that lowest of heavens, it's only, what, 25 days ago for them that the Buddha was there, meditating, becoming enlightened and teaching. That's not that long ago. So some of those devas are still around, just hanging around. And that's some of the energy we can feel. So, the turnaround, it can be any sort of turnaround. If it's, you go up to heaven realm, it's a long turnaround period. If you come, you know, from human birth to human birth, it's a short turnaround period. Or if you're reborn as a cockroach, it's a very short turnaround period. Mosquito, even less. You get born as a mosquito, and that's it. Oh, more mosquitoes, they don't have long. Any questions about those questions so far? Yeah.
The first question?
Yeah, what's that one?
The one with the monkey mind?
Oh, the monkey mind, yeah. When the fault-finding monkey mind comes, don't find fault with the fault-finding monkey mind, because it just gets worse and worse. Human beings are like this, they're so complex. So the thing is, the fault-finding mind is a bad habit. So you have to train yourself out of that bad habit by, you know, being more generous and not so fault-finding with the monks, with the nuns, you know, with your body, with yourself, with the food, with life, with the buses, with the aircraft and everything else which you can find fault with in life. And be, you know, develop more gratitude and appreciation for things, more praise. And that's a great way of overcoming the fault-finding mind, because when there's, you know, not so many things to complain about, you find you have more peace in life. Some people just complain about everything. And they say, if they can't find a friend, because no friend is good enough. They can't find a partner in life, because, you know, just no one is good enough. And they can't find a job, and they can't find even a place to stay, because no apartment or house is, or land is good enough. They're always on the move. They're restless. And sometimes, no, this apartment's good enough, this monastery's good enough, this hut's good enough, this body's good enough. Is your body good enough? Are you trying to get another one in your next life? Yeah, it's not the best body, but it's good enough. It's a bit of an old bomb of a vehicle, but yeah, it gets you from A to B. That's good enough. And that way, you sort of, you know, you can be more content. When you're content, this is good enough, you become peaceful, and the monkey mind stops. Yeah, okay, there's bananas in the forest. It'll be there after the meditation. It'll be content. Forget about it. Instead of going off, let's get this out of the way. Let's get this out of the way. Does that make any sense? Or do you want to ask another question? Very good, okay. You're very content. I was testing you out to see whether that answer was good enough. Dear Agar Brahm, until today I was under the impression I am passively watching my breath. Today, I try to relax my as much as possible, and now my breath is running wild and becoming unstable. Have I been controlling it all along? What can I do? Please turn the page. How do you know if the do is controlling the breath? Great question. The do is controlling the breath. If the breath gets more and more agitated, doesn't matter what you start off with. Remember when I put the cup down? The water, when you put it down, it does move more and more at the beginning. So if you're really relaxing and letting go, you can expect your breath to move a little bit more, but be more agitated at the beginning. But if you really keep that relaxation, that letting go, and it really is letting go, putting the thing down, the water will move less and less. Your breath, even though it is, seems to be more unstable than it was usually, it should be getting more stable. The more you relax, the more you let go. So the sign of letting go is how things are changing and maturing. If they get more and more peaceful, I'm not saying where they start off from, if they are developing more and more peacefully, more and more calm, then you are letting go. If they're getting worse, doesn't matter where they're starting off from, if they're getting worse, 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 then you're controlling somewhere. Have a look and see what you're doing. If you're really, no, really relaxing, sometimes the breath gets unstable and you think, oh, it shouldn't be unstable. You're not sort of controlling it again, you're measuring it. If the breath is unstable, oh, just let it be unstable. Make peace with it, let it go, it's okay. And then it becomes peaceful. Hopefully I've got that sort of, that point. I mention it every time. So that should be the right answer there. Tiredness can produce that because your mindfulness is weak and you can't really see what you're doing. And when your mindfulness is weak, you don't know what you're up to, so sometimes you can make a mess of everything. That's why that when you really are tired, and you're generally tired, just go and take a break. Have a cup of tea, just go for a walk. Go sit under a tree and wait for a tree branch to fall on you, that'll wake you up. Dear Ajahn, if I don't measure good or bad meditation, there's nothing to do. If there's nothing to do, I'm not needed. Does that mean I can go on vacation, the remaining of the retreat, and enjoy just hanging around and not doing anything? I tried that the last few hours and had a pleasant day when I gave up trying to meditate, but the problem of suffering is still there since I still exist. I'm still here. I wouldn't be wasting my time if I carried on like this. Surely I must try something. If I give up and do nothing, I'll never get enlightened. Are you sure I'm not needed? Maybe I must guard to suppress and restrain and say, stop, should I do that? If I'm tired from doing meditation, I'll be wasting time from doing meditation. I'll be wasting time and never get anywhere. Okay, thinking too much. Which is an obvious one there. So the way is. I think I nailed someone there. So when this happens, you know, you don't measure good or bad, then maybe there's not just nothing to do, there's nothing to think about. And again, when you don't exist, you shut up. And when you shut up, there's silence there. And basically, the suffering is almost gone. So, you know, suffering is, you know, the measuring. You know, this is good, this is bad, and it's got something to do. The Buddha said, actually, that suffering is the separation from the light, or the association with the dislike, not getting what you want. And that all comes from, you know, just measuring, you know, I want this, I don't want that. You know, what you prefer, what you don't like. When you don't measure, how can you like or not like anything? all those likes and dislikes go. And when there's no likes and dislikes, all the wanting can't arise. And when there's no wanting doesn't arise, how can craving arise? Your mind just doesn't get agitated. It stops, becomes still. So when you do these things, these non-measuring, you've got to do it 100%, not 99%. Otherwise, you know, you measure some things, but you don't measure others, and it doesn't work. So you've got to completely abandon, let go. So what if you exist or you don't exist? That's just measuring yourself again. So just even existence and non-existence just disappears from your vocabulary. If you really don't measure, you can't think at all. There's nothing to give a standard to your thinking. And you get completely confounded, bamboozled. So you become speechless, which is the whole point of no measuring. Takes away all, because you know, all speech, all language is a measure, is a comparison, is a way of describing this world in terms of something else and measuring it. So really, when you stop measuring, language has got no ground anymore. It just vanishes. When language vanishes, you can't think. You're still, and there's nothing to do. Because you're still, mindfulness increases, energy comes up, you become enlightened very quickly. So, stop the measuring business. Does it make sense? You know what we use for measuring society is a balance? For non-measuring, this means becoming unbalanced. That's only a joke, you're not really becoming unbalanced. Dear Ajahn, how to stop inner speech? Thank you. That's the answer. Shut up. Sometimes if you can't do the inner speech, you know we have, I've already given you a couple of mantras. You know, that I will die, that's for sure. In Thailand they used to use the mantra Buddho, breathing in, Bud, breathing out, Tho. You say that to yourself inside, don't say it with your mouth. Say it inside, you know, Buddho, Buddho, Buddho with your breath. Sometimes in Thailand that stops the inner speech because you have a speech there, you know, Buddho, Buddho, but it's repeated, it's simple, and it sort of blocks out any other possibility of speech. So you might try that if you want to. As you're breathing in, Bud, breathing out, Tho. Bud, or Buddha if you like, Buddha. But Tho seems to be easier to say, Buddho, because you're exhaling and the O is exhaling a bit of breath as well. So Buddho with the breath, Bud, Tho, Bud, Tho, Bud, Tho. You get nice and calm. And because you've got something to do, it sort of means the inner speech sort of just can't really get a hold on your mind. If that doesn't work, and it didn't work for many Westerners when I first taught it, so I gave them another mantra, especially tailored to Australians and Europeans and Americans. Instead of using Buddho, as you breathe in, you recite the word to yourself, shut, as you breathe out, up. Shut, up, shut, up, shut, up, with the breath. And eventually, the word, you know, the meaning gets in. You know, eventually, maybe out of half an hour, sort of something clicks and you do shut up after a long time. So that's the Australian mantra, instead of Buddha, shut up, shut up. Now, it may sound like a joke, but it actually works. If you do that to yourself, you say shut up, straight away, you're something that you will spot, burst out loud. But also, it does actually shut you up, because you're telling yourself, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, but slowly and gently over a long time. And eventually it does brainwash you to shut up, but you're brainwashing yourself. So try and use the mantras. But, you know, I like the best one. It's like, you know, when I did that first day here, the space between the thoughts, when you speak and there's a gap. You can play around with that yourself. You know, you start speaking and pause in between and listen to those gaps between your speech. And then start thinking and listen to the gaps between your thoughts. And then you notice even in inner speech, even when you've got lots to think about, there'll always be gaps there. And when you notice the gaps and the spaces between your speech, you will also notice a far more presence than what's outside the speech, what's outside the gaps, in other words, in the speech itself. And when you really
see the beauty of the silence, the space between the words. That grows at the expense of the words. You find you spend more time in silence and less in speech. Thoughts get squashed out of your mind as the silence grows and takes over. That's, I think, the nicest way to develop the silence of the mind, to overcome the inner speech. Because it's not by trying to get rid of the silence, it's actually by something very positive, seeing what is even nicer than the silence, than the speech, the silence. So it's using the positive recognition of the superior beauty of silence. So that takes over. And the lesser importance of inner speech fades away. Any questions about that or comments about that one? Okay. Dear Ajahn, I think I've got an insight today. Whee! Or maybe I'm just a little slow to catch on. I was confused when you said we should let go of our will completely. Is that only for meditation or also in our daily lives? If so, how does anyone make anything happen at all? Without will or any sort of planning, none of us would have made it to this retreat. Yes, so you've done all the planning, so you're here now. So no more willing, which means you can never leave. No, so then I realized that when we will for something to happen, we may make it happen, but if we let go of the will, we let things run its natural course and let it happen, things still happen nonetheless. That's very good. So you know you're not important anymore. The world happens when you're not running the show. In fact, when you get out of the way, the world usually runs more smoothly. It's true. I've often told the story that someone told me this, that I haven't got the evidence. I should find the evidence one day, otherwise somebody will sue me. That in Israel, many, many years ago, in Jerusalem, the doctors in all the main hospitals went on strike. They took about 2 weeks off. None of them went to work. And in those 2 weeks when the doctors weren't on the job, the death rate plummeted. More people survived when the doctors weren't working. That's an interesting statistic. Doctors are bad for your health, according to that statistic. But there's a few doctors here, I might get in trouble. But you think that things are going to go wrong when the traffic lights don't work, but traffic usually flows more freely when the traffic lights doesn't work. When people don't control things, actually things flow much more easy. If I had controlled this retreat and had a big bell at 4 o'clock and had to get up at 4:30, and like some retreats actually they send people to your room to drag you out if you're not up for the first meditation. They do. Someone told me that. And in other retreats, in these Zen retreats, when you're meditating, if you're asleep, whack, they're on the back with a big stick. Wow, you've got it really soft in this retreat. Anyhow, you could do that and tell people to shut up and be quiet. And I could really interrogate you, like the cartoon outside, you know, and just really control you. But if I did that, would it be better or worse? I think you'd all know by now, you'd be much worse. You wouldn't have any much peace at all. You'd be just too stiff. And so you can see that too much control just creates just the wrong type of atmosphere for the peace and gentleness of meditation. So because of that, you're amazing. When you just let go, things happen. They happen really smoothly. Everyone has been a manager. You'll probably know that when you first become like abbot of a monastery, you're a control freak. I've seen that many times in other monasteries, and I probably was the same myself. But after 1 year or 2 years, you get your confidence, you just let go, and you trust your monks. Those monks who want to practice will. Those who don't, no matter how much you force them, they never will. So that way you trust, and you get much more out of your monks when you trust them, when you're kind to them. You find that people actually practice many more hours when you don't have any bells. So that's why when you get out of the way, things still happen. In fact, they happen very well. Can we go the middle way where we will for something, therefore we make plans, and then once we're done planning, we let go of our control and let nature take over? Just like the garden simile. If I wanted a rose garden, I need to plant roses first. Only after do I take the role of the mindful garden and let it grow naturally. Please comment.
Now I like native gardens, so you don't plant anything, you just see what comes up. Because what native gardens mean is weeds. No, sometimes you've got to take out those weeds, because people say they're bad for you. But anyhow, the answer to that question obviously is, when you're meditating, then you let go. So I always tell whoever's going to drive me back to the monastery on Saturday, please don't let go. Please concentrate. Please don't say when you're driving back to the monastery, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. That's the meditation. Now you're driving. Take care, for goodness sake. So usually, this is when we're meditating. When we are meditating, that's actually when we do the letting go. This is our rest period. That's how we get deep meditation. But other times we do our duties. And we have to exert, you know, our will. We arouse our will, and we do what needs to be done. But it's also what they said, it's very, very good, that sometimes when we do have a will, it always has to be tentative. We always have to make sure we have the provision, it's not going to work the way we intended. So we don't get frustrated. All plans should be tentative. Maybe. You should always have a plan B. Never just have a plan A. That make sense? Okay. So Ajahn, you said you knew you were meant to be a monk. I might want to be a nun. If it is meant to be, how would I know? What are the symptoms? You lose your hair? Well, the symptom, if you want to be a nun, the first symptom of wanting to become a nun is being a woman. That's a prerequisite. And it's also that sometimes it's not, don't think because, you know, you hate men or you hate the world and you're really upset about life and life has no meaning. That's not a symptom for becoming a monk or a nun. It's not that it's something you don't like, it's something which you like. You're attracted to the lifestyle. It's not out of negativity, but out of, you know, seeing being a monk or a nun is a wonderful lifestyle. It's a positiveness of, like, Sangha life. That's what sort of draws you in. Because I've seen that many people have come to my house, I'm fed up with the world, I don't want to sort of live in this world any longer, sort of, I want to be a monk, ordain me, I've had it with this world. People like that, they come with negativity, and then they start getting negative to the monastery. I hate this monastery, I don't want to stay here. It's all the same attitude. So the best attitude is not when they sort of want to leave the world out of suffering and hatred for the world. They never make a monk or nun then. They become a monk or nun, especially because they see the positive and beauty of that lifestyle. And in particular, you know, because especially our monasteries, they're based on the meditation practice. And it's basically, in most of those monasteries, nothing else to do most of the day. So we don't do that much physical work, you know, and don't do other work except maybe myself because I have to run the joint. But there's so much time, even for myself, for meditation. So if you don't know how to meditate, you get bored out of your skull being a monk or a nun. So your meditation has to be one of the major reasons why you want to be a monk or a nun. And if your meditation really starts to take off and you get very peaceful and you really enjoy that, then that is a good symptom that, you know, you're inclined towards renouncing even more. Sometimes it's very hard to tell. That's why that I usually give many people the chance to become monks. And Novice Sister gives people a chance to become nuns. And some of them will never make it, but you give them a chance just to see. Because I've seen some of the most unlikely characters. People, you know, that I would never have ordained myself, but someone else ordains, and they become great monks. It's really weird, and sometimes you just cannot tell until you give a person a chance. Some of them blossom unexpectedly. And some of the people you think, wow, you know, they're born a monk, they should stay as a monk forever. Sometimes they don't last. So it's very hard, even, you know, how many years I've been a monk, to actually to tell who's going to make the good monk and who isn't going to make the good monk. So it's very hard to see those signs. I can't see them in another. So I give people a chance. Many of them don't make it, but at least they had a chance. So any questions about that? So, how many people want to become a monk? Become a nun? Shall we ordain them now? Maybe you don't want to go home. No, you just have to be serious. It's a big decision, so you don't want to make it too easily.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please explain the chain of dependent origination in layman's terms and layman's terms, and how where the cycle breaks when a being becomes enlightened? Okay, remember what dependent origination is? It's explaining just how the process of rebirth happens. And basically there are two factors, two causes, which is karma and craving. So karma is just all the accumulated merit or demerit you've made. I call that the wherewithal, or the, your amount of money you have in the bank, which gives you the ability to do this and do that. If you've got no money, you're limited. If you've got heaps of money, there's many things you can do. And the craving is the will. To give you a simile, which I've given almost every retreat, if you want to go to, say, Paris, if you're going to get to Paris, there's two things which you need. First of all, the air ticket, and or the money to buy the air ticket, and secondly, you want to go there. If you want to go there but got no money, you won't arrive. If you have the money but don't want to go there, you won't arrive. You need both to arrive. The money is like the store of karma, and the wanting to go there is your craving. So your rebirth, where you want to get rebirth, reborn, Deva realm, another human realm, or whatever, depends on how much karma you've accumulated. So sometimes people, they might want to go and be reborn in the Deva realm, but they haven't got the karmic wherewithal. Sometimes they want to be reborn as a human being, but they can't because their karma is not sufficient. So it's how much karma you've got is one important factor of rebirth. And the second is actually where you want to be reborn. So sometimes people have got huge amounts of good karma. And I've known this, I've seen this even in Perth. But some people say, no, they don't want to be reborn in the heaven realm. They don't want to be they don't know what it's like. They don't want to be reborn as a human being. They want to be reborn as a dog. And they want to be reborn as a dog for it. So because you don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. You just sit down and lie around all day and you get really well fed, especially here in a city like Perth. You get exercise, you can sit down, you just all the only work you have to do is to lay down and be stroked, you know, to sort of, you know, earn your food, to give some emotional support to your owners. That's all the job you have to do as a dog. It's a great life as a dog, sleeping around all day, lying around, playing with a bone, eating really good food. You don't have to work for your food, no stress. Wouldn't it be nice being a dog? Do you really want to go to school? Dogs don't have to go to school. So sometimes people think, wow, yeah, when you look at it, being a dog in a rich person's house, you know, that's almost like a heaven realm. Just hang around all day, have a nice time, just play around, have fun. But then I tell them that in Australia, many dogs have to go to the vet, first of all, to get monasticized. And when I tell them that, they say, I don't want to be a dog. I don't want to operate, especially males think that. But you can see that, I can understand that sometimes people, you know, who haven't really got much wisdom, they say, yeah, okay, I'll go be a dog in my next life, because that's good fun. Sometimes people think, yeah, they want to be rich in their next life. So that's what they want. And they're just as stupid as people who want to be dogs. If you are rich, you have huge amounts of headaches. If you are poor, huge amounts of headaches. The really wise people, maybe you have enough good karma to be reborn in a rich family and be rich, or be famous, or open the bowling for Sri Lanka cricket team in your next lifetime, whatever else you want to do. Those sorts of people, sort of, you know, if they have the wherewithal, they get reborn there, and they have a terrible time. The wise people, they have enough good karma to be a champion bowler, or be prime minister of Thailand, or whatever. But no way will they go that path. They've got the good karma, they haven't got the will to do that, because they're wise, knowing if you put yourself in a prominent position, you just get more and more suffering. So, you can see the karma. What do you want? And have you got the ability to do that? And that creates your rebirth. Now, where that actually comes from, you know, it comes from a lot of this delusion business. Now, why do we want to get reborn again? I want to get reborn again because
My wife has died and I loved her very much and I want to meet her again in the next life. And now I'm pining for I can't wait until we meet again and have our arguments all over again. So many people actually fall around and they get reborn into the same families. Happens very often. Why do they do that? Attachments. The delusions which create those attachments. So sometimes, even now, there are some people, they follow like some religions and they say, no, I want to get reborn again so I can actually get the teachings of Maitreya the Buddha. So no, I don't want to get enlightened now, I'm going to wait till Maitreya comes. That's again, it's a delusion, it creates rebirth again. So it's a delusion, a stupidity, not seeing it clearly. And that is why we have these wantings and cravings, and we make the karma, we use the karma, we have the deluded cravings, and then we get reborn here, then all over the place. Now many people have the dreams and aspirations of being, if you're a girl, being the supermodel, being the film star, you know, being the rich person. And just many people even in this life have the dream of winning the lottery and having more money than you can ever want. People actually, Thai people tell me that. Ajahn Bhavi, only give me a lottery number, we'll give a donation to the retreat center. And I ask them, what percentage? And they say 10%. I said, that's not good enough, I want 90. But I do all the way. I'm only joking, never do such things. I'm only having good fun and games. But you can see just what people think and they're what they want. They're deluded. So really, it's a delusion creates a craving which creates the rebirth. That's dependent origination. Now, the way we stop that, now where this is broken, is by overcoming delusion. What do you want? What do you want anyway? You know, we want peace. That's the main reason for life. We want money so we can have peace of mind. Or, you know, we want power so we can solve the problems in the world and then we can have a bit of peace. If you really understand what you want, what do you really want? And investigate that, you find what everyone wants is just peace. Peace of mind is the highest goal. So that's one of the reflections you can do. Sometimes I did that when I had a restless mind. Sometimes I would say, what do I want? What do I want? Why am I restless? And I kept on looking, what do I want? What do I want? What do I want? What do I want? And after a while, I don't want anything. And my restlessness has disappeared then. What do you want? Do you want to get married? Nah. You know, do you want something to eat? Nah, I've had that already. Do you want to have a rest? Nah. Do you want to watch a movie? Nah. What do you want? Dunno. And in the end, didn't want anything. So let's let go of wanting. So that, you can see the stupidity of wanting. Because most wanting is blind wanting. You just want, but you're not quite sure what. It's just a bad habit, that's all. When you actually see with wisdom, you can see that all this wanting, where it really comes from, it's like, it promises you something which it will never give you. And that's why when you see through the wanting, that what it promises you will never supply. In other words, it will never supply you happiness. Wanting causes more suffering, never happiness. When you see that, then you realize stopping wanting, that creates the happiness which wanting promised anyway. Contentment, letting go, that creates the happiness. This is what you learn in meditation. The happiest moments are when you want for nothing. So that message gets through, that peace, peace of mind, calmness, contentment, letting go, being kind, being gentle, being at peace, is the highest happiness. So you stop all your wanting. And because the wisdom, the insights based on experience, that wanting creates suffering and peace is created by not wanting, you let go and renounce more and more. Until the ability to let go and renounce, just to be still, is so great, because of your insights and understandings, the end of death, end of your life, you just don't want for anything. And because you don't want, just like you're at the airport, you've got all the money in the world, but I don't want to go anywhere, therefore you'll never get on the plane. So you stop. You just pass away.
at Perth International Airport. Never to get any other tickets to go to any other country. No more birth. So that's actually where it stops, on understanding what delusion is and the stupidity of wanting. It's also, I should have said deeper, why do you want? It's, part of that is the ego, because you think you exist, that's what you have to do. Does that make any sense? That's dependent origination, in a nutshell. Dear Bhante, I've been considering my ego. Who's been considering your ego? It's been like an expensive imported car. It costs a lot to maintain and repair, especially accessories. It's unreliable and runs rough. It also injures other road users. Then to add insult to injury, we find out it doesn't even exist. The salesman conned us. Yeah, you've been conned. Outside meditation, what can be done in daily life to reduce the ego? I thought of eating more simply, spending less on myself, being more generous and forgiving and less righteous. Do you have any advice? Thank you. Yeah, go and do it. In other words, the ego comes when you don't measure. That's a nice way of letting go of your ego. Who's got the best ego? Who's got the best meditation in this retreat? Who knows more about Buddhism, the monks or the nuns? Which tradition has got the best Buddhism? Sri Lankan Buddhism, Thai Buddhism, Norwegian Buddhism? Who's got the best Buddhism? It's amazing just how we can get egos when we measure things. And sometimes when a person has an ego, they also have the terrible part of the ego as well. I'm hopeless. I'm terrible. Probably everyone else in this whole retreat has got jhanas by now. But I haven't even got in the present moment, not even once. And that's also ego. And that was one of the major teachings of the Buddha. There's three types of conceit. One is, I am the best. The other one, I am worse. And the other one is, I am the same. They have really powerful wisdom teachings. All three are conceits. In the West, we only know I'm better. Yeah, we all know that's a conceit. That's ego. But did you know that feeling you're worse is also ego? It's making yourself. And a lot of times, the two of them go together. Sometimes you think you're better, but underneath, you know you're worse. There are two sides of the same coin. They're inseparable. So that's why... That's both ego. People think, oh, I'm terrible, I'm hopeless. Yeah, you've got big ego. That really shocks them. And the same also, this idea of equity, we're all the same. That's also ego. And the Buddha says, there's no person in there anyway. How can you compare one with another, apples with oranges? Every human being is completely different. And even just in one day, you're so many different people. So how can you even judge better, worse, same? They're all delusions. So you stop comparing, you stop measuring. And when you stop measuring, ego disappears. For those of you who know a little bit, a tiny bit of Pali, because sometimes the old languages actually give you some really interesting insights. You know what the word for measure is? It's called manati. You know the word for mind? It's mano. Basically, to measure is what the mind does. Having a mind means you measure. So when you stop measuring, your mind disappears. In other words, you can't think, nothing to do. You vanish when you stop measuring. And it's such a relief not to have to measure things. Am I better or worse than I was yesterday? Oh, what a pain. Is your meditation improving or getting worse? What a pain to even think like that. It's just changing. It's different, that's all. It's not better, it's not worse. It's just evolving. So you don't even measure anything. And imagine how much peace you have when you don't sort of, let's see, is my meditation this retreat better than the last retreat? Or is it worse, or is it the same? Aren't you wasting a lot of time by that? Anyway, do you really know what it was in the last retreat? It's just some vague memory. Sometimes you just remember part of what happened, you forget all the rest. So, stop all this measuring business and your ego disappears. And then so does all of your business and trouble and worries and stuff. So, ego, she go, we all go. Right?
You've been a great teacher and a great student of the Dhamma.
Yes, I am the great teacher. I am the great student.
But you forget. You didn't get off all of that afterwards. You're only having fun and games. Mr. Buddha would have been so proud to know that you've been praising part of your teaching on so well. Well done, congratulations, thank you, signed Ajahn Brahm. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when people take pain, I didn't say that, I just made that up. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when people take painkillers, it reduces identification of suffering. Does this take people away from the first truth of Buddhism? No, it takes you closer to the third truth of Buddhism, the ending of suffering. It's called the middle way. You know that otherwise, you know that if you want to see suffering, then don't eat and don't sleep. Is that really the path to overcome suffering? Just actually seeking out suffering does not end suffering. You know, you don't need to seek it out. Many suffering just comes to you anyway. So you don't need to sit on broken glass for no suffering. Sitting on your cushions is already hurting enough. So that's why we don't go around seeking suffering. So if you've got a headache, you know, drink some water, or if you've got some trouble with your body and had an injury, take some painkillers. You know, just be moderate. So don't sort of try and be some tough guy or tough girl and just think how strong you are. It's really how stupid you are. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do you define enlightenment? Aha. Enlightenment is, I was going to say beyond definition, but that's really wrong because this is my old, should I say this tomorrow? I'll give a talk on enlightenment tomorrow. So, can I leave that one until tomorrow? How to define enlightenment? So, talk about it tomorrow. Does one have the choice of being reborn or learning the lessons in another way? Because you don't have choice anyway. Sometimes it's will. Sometimes it's conditioning. You can end choice by stopping or letting go. Otherwise, your choice is actually quite sort of conditioned. Which is why that sometimes people think, they get reborn in Sri Lanka because that's the home of Buddhism and that's why people keep getting reborn in Sri Lanka if that's what you want, but that's a delusion as well. Where is the home of Buddhism? In your heart, yes, well done. Not in any country, in people's hearts. So, have the choice of being reborn or learn lessons in another way. Really, that most people, they choose to be reborn, but where you get reborn, I shouldn't say that. You don't have, most people, they're so conditioned, they have to get reborn, they don't know how to stop the process. And a lot of time, the exercise of choice is not whether I be reborn or not reborn. Most people's exercise of choice is, shall I be reborn here or shall I be reborn there? That's where many people exercise their choice. But even that choice is conditioned. Years ago, somebody asked me the great question is, why do people go to hell? Is there some being which sends you down to hell? And in traditional Buddhism, they said that being was like Yama. It's actually a heavenly being. That made no sense to me. How can any heavenly being send a person to heaven, to hell? Because if I was ever reborn in that position, if I got reborn as Yama, God, and I saw Diha come up to me and say, well, you've done all that terrible things, but nah, never mind, you're a good mate, you can go up to heaven. I'd actually be so kind that, I wouldn't send anyone down to hell. I'd say, never mind, I'll forgive you, hope you go to heaven. Osama bin Laden, you blew up those Bamiyan Buddha statues, but never mind, I can go up to heaven as well. Adolf Hitler, but you're vegetarian. You can go up to heaven. Mr. Bush, it's a tough one, Mr. Bush, but, you can go up to heaven too. If I was Yahweh, the king of the gods, I'd let anyone go up to heaven, because they have compassion and kindness, which is what you're supposed to have as a heavenly being. Now, if there's a monk living in this world has such kindness, why can't Yama have? So that really confused me. But after a while, you realize that just anyone who knows any psychology, that the answer is, it's not someone sends you down to hell, it's not some judge who looks at your record and sends you down there, that you send yourself to hell. If you think that's what you deserve, If you're guilty and you have this guilt trip that you need punishing to teach you a lesson, then you'll send yourself down to hell for as however long you think you deserve it. And understanding that, the nature of the mind, you understand why. If a person really understands the nature of the mind and understands no self, no way will you ever go to hell again. And that's the stream winner. Stream winner can't go to hell again. It's not they haven't done bad karma. There's no causes or crimes which, you know, look at Angulimala. It's not the case of that crimes they haven't committed which they deserve to go to hell. But they decide to forgive themselves and let go. It's amazing. Why can't people do that? No one judges you. You judge yourself. And if you know about the non-measuring, you don't even do that much. So no judging means you can't get reborn anywhere. You're enlightened. Done. Finished. But when you have judging, so often people judge themselves harder than anybody else. That's why I wouldn't send anyone to hell. Maybe you wouldn't send anyone to hell. But you'll send yourself to hell. And you do that even in this life sometimes. So you can see what would happen when you die. So that's how people go to hell. They choose to go to hell. Because they think they deserve it. It's bad choice. Bad conditioning. Yeah. Yeah, nice. Because Buddhism isn't about punishing. If they really have any remorse, they acknowledge it, they forgive, and learn, and do better next time. Yes. Well, I think, sort of, if... Yeah, they wouldn't be able to do that because any psychologist would know that it's sometimes the people who feel guilty, they're the ones who actually take it out on other people as well as themselves. And anger as well. So if a person could really do that, if that was possible, the person who does some bad karma forgives themselves and let it go, then there wouldn't be somebody who goes and gets angry at other people and hurts them. They'd be able to let other people's bad actions go as well. So basically, without being able to let go of the pain of your past makes it very easy to let go of the pain which other people cause you, or the pain of life. You just let everything go. So you become an incredibly virtuous person. It becomes almost impossible to do bad karma if you're something like that. The people who are into a punishing trip, they punish themselves, they're going to punish somebody else for messing them up. And they go into a bomb Iraq where they go and cause huge amounts of problems. So if there is no remorse, really no remorse, because you understand the nature of these things, then you're just that far off from enlightenment, hardly matters. Most people can't do that. That's one of the things I tell people when I went to go visit prisons and jails and go talk to those prisoners. It was amazing that when you got to know all these prisoners, every one of them, without exception, would come up and say they felt terrible for what they did. They all had a bad conscience. They really felt it very deeply, very badly. And they would hide it to other people because you got to know them and they got to trust you and opened up to you. It's amazing just the suffering they were doing in the jail. Simply because, not because they were in jail, because they knew what they'd done. And they hated it. They wished they hadn't done that. If only. I hadn't done that crime. They all feel guilty. So it's very hard to find someone with no remorse. Angulimala would be able to do that. But he was enlightened. He would acknowledge, forgive, learn and move on. Yeah. Yeah, if you're killing your own mother, killing your own father, it's an interesting one, because what happens as a Buddhist, if it's your mother and it's on the ventilator and the doctor says, John, it's your father there, I don't think they're going to survive, can you turn the machine off? And it's your decision. If you say, okay, doctor, turn the machine off, and you've killed your father, does that mean, John, no way you can get enlightened in this life? Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, no, that's an interesting one. Why it's such bad karma that can be not forgiving. Maybe it's just in that particular culture and time, if you knew you killed your father or your mother. Maybe just, you know, that was something you couldn't forgive yourself. Because I like to, you know, I ask why. Why is that the case? What would happen, you know, if you did kill somebody by an accident and you realised that was your biological father, but you'd been adopted when you were very young and you didn't really know it was your father? Would that still have the same karmic force of, you know, of knowing it was your father and killing them? And if you used to kill someone you didn't realise it was your biological father, would that mean that it's... Because this is... I should actually say, because John knows this, in classical Buddhism it says there are some crimes which if you do you cannot get enlightened in this life. One of them is actually killing your mother or killing your father. Shedding the blood of the Buddha, seducing a bhikkhuni. What else is there? Killing an arahat. If you do anything like that, it means no chance you get enlightened in this lifetime. So there's lots of things. Why? Why is that the case? Can't anyone just let go and forgive? And I don't really know the answer to that question. Because I like to understand why. Maybe it wasn't such a hard and fast. Maybe the Antarayaka Dhammas meant it was a big danger, a big obstacle. But maybe it could be overcome. I don't know. So, a very deep question there from John. But we have to have a few more before we can go to bed. I was fortunate enough to be with my dad and mum when they passed away. Aha! My dad was in a coma for 3 days before he died. My mum was in a coma for 6 days before she died. You spoke about the need to keep your mind still at the time of death. How do I keep my mind still if I'm in a coma at the time of death? With metta. Okay, what happens when you're in a coma? It does not mean your mind isn't moving. Ajahn Chah was in a coma, well, at least he couldn't speak anyway, for many years, but he still got into his jhanas while he was with the doctors, not being able to speak. You've all heard those evidences in my book. I was right about that in my book, Marvelous Bliss and Beyond. But anyway, you've probably heard that story before. Did I tell that story also about the... I think I did tell the story, didn't I, about the person who became awake after being in a coma because his brain was being eaten away by the brain tumour? Yeah. The last 15 minutes, they came out of that coma because the brain had been eaten away by the tumour. And they just were cogent and talking, eyes open, holding the hands of their loved ones for the last 15 minutes before they passed away. Very often, even in a so-called coma, the last seconds you're perfectly alert and awake. If the coma is caused by some damage to your brain, the mind, it seems, usually makes use of the brain during its life, but doesn't have to. You can actually bypass the brain and just exist by itself. And I think that's what happens at that particular time when that person whose brain was eaten away by the tumour, as he died, his mind sort of bypassed the dysfunctional brain and could activate the body by itself and just be able to speak even without a brain. The mind is far stronger than the brain. And you all know those cases of, for example, the boy with no brain, which I've mentioned. Did I mention that this retreat so far? The boy with no brain in 1983 or 4 or something. Professor John Lauber of Sheffield University. His field of research was, does the shape of the human skull, especially if it's slightly misshaped, have any effect on a person's intelligence or social life? Now, what happens if their skull is deformed? What effect does it have on them? And for his research data, he would spot students or even staff or even anybody on the campus whose head was slightly misshaped. And if he saw them, he'd invite them onto the program, give them a few pounds, and find out whether their misshapen skull had any effect on their life.
And one day he saw this student whose skull was slightly malformed, invited him onto the program, gave him a few pounds, and one of the first thing they did was to give him an MRI scan. No, sorry, a CT scan. Didn't have MRIs those days. A CT scan of his brain. And when Professor John Lauber, to his great consternation and surprise, found the boy did not have a brain, it was full of intracranial fluid. And there was a man without a brain. He was actually graduated in mathematics with honours. He had an IQ of about 140. He had a girlfriend. He was more normal than normal. He didn't seem to have any sort of social problems at all. And there he had no brain. It became the classical case of the boy with no brain. And it's nice to do this experiment at this time of night. Could you move your head back and forth? And if you hear any sloshing inside, it means you've got no brain as well, just intracranial fluid. They said actually his brain cortex was 1%. He still had a tiny bit of brain there. But most neurologists say there's no way that could compensate for all the stuff which was missing. No way should he be alive, let alone be an honest student in mathematics. He didn't have a brain. And there are other cases when people have been brain dead. When they have these near-death experiences, where they are fully conscious and they can record everything which happened. The BBC did a program of that which somebody showed me, and it had one of my heroes, Professor Pim van Lommel, who was one of the first researchers. He researched and put it in Lancet magazine, 2001 December edition, where he was researching everybody who came into three or four hospitals in the Netherlands who had cardiac arrest. And he gave them questionnaires afterwards to see if any of them had these near-death experiences when on the operating table you float out and you can see and hear what's going on. So he could record what actually went on and record in the questionnaire what they thought went on, to see whether these were real near-death experiences, and also to take all the medical descriptions of what they were experiencing at the time. And he found 10% of the people in his sample who came in with cardiac arrest, 10% had these near-death experiences, and they were valid. What they said happened was actually what happened. So there was no doubt that they had seen and heard real events. That the crux of his research, he discovered that it was only the people who came in with cardiac arrest who were also brain dead. Only those had the near-death experiences. If your brain was alive and active, you didn't have them at all. And that surprising finding also led to the conclusion that those experiences could not be produced by the brain, because the brain was dead at the time. It was not working. And in this little documentary, Pim van Lommel was arguing with Susan Blackmore, a famous neurologist from Oxford University. And Susan Blackmore was saying, no, the only explanation is just at the time of death, that your brain gets flooded with neurons, and this produces that illusion, and sometimes that, yeah, they're picking up something, but it's not really at the time when brain dead, but at the time when the brain is about to die. And she said, if you can find one case when they remember something which very clearly happened when the brain was dead, would you reverse your suggestion? She said, I'd have to. And then they presented the evidence. There was a girl in the United States who had an aneurysm at the base of her brain. That's one of the arteries had got so loose, so weak, it ballooned and was about to burst. Certain death. But no one was willing to operate on her, because to get to that part of your brain you had to go through so much other brain, you probably destroyed too much. It had never been done before. But they found one doctor in Colorado who had an experimental technique of freezing the body, and especially the brain, to such a low temperature that everything stopped. They just wondered whether you could actually unfreeze them afterwards. Because it was experimental and because this lady knew that if she did nothing, she would certainly die, she signed the consent forms. So they froze her. They took out her brain, the whole brain, so they could get underneath where the aneurysm was, fix it up, put it back again, and then unfreeze her. It was successful, just a new experimental technique which worked. But while her brain was completely frozen, the anaesthetist, who was a friend of Roger Penrose, you know, from Oxford, who was into these near-death experiences, he said that if one neuron had fired, I would have seen it. He had all the gizmos on that brain. He said no neuron fired. It was just far too cold to act. It was frozen. And she had full memory of what happened when her brain was taken out. She recorded, she remembered everything. She was outside of her body, looking over the shoulder of the person doing the operation, and could describe in very clear detail what happened. And in particular, in the movie, she told them, "Yeah, you took out my false teeth and you put them on the drawer on the right, third one along, just second from the top." Which was absolutely accurate. She'd seen that, but they only took the teeth out when she was dead for a few hours. There's a certain case, she had no brain, but she was conscious. It just shows you that you don't need a brain to be conscious and aware. Which means when you're in a coma, before you die, when your brain dies and stops, you can still be alert and conscious. And you will be. So, when your brain dies, and you're conscious, what should you do? Be kind, be gentle, be peaceful and let go. So it's easy. So it doesn't matter if you're in a coma or not in a coma, because when you die, it's all the same. You know that. So there we go, very easy. Last question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can you please explain more on the soul? Yeah, very easy. The soul does not exist. There's no one in there. And if you want to buy my soul, it's on special offer this weekend. An old rag, it's like an old bomb, it doesn't exist, it's a fantasy. But what do we mean as a soul? It's something which came up from Christianity, an essential part of you. What is the essence of you? What is the core of you? Which is why that we do this meditation, instead of believing what other people say, or just feeling, yeah, I kind of feel I exist, but actually be much more rational than that, much more experimental, and go right to the source of things. What do you think this soul is? So you start the investigation. What is this soul? Anyway, if you think you have a soul, what is it? Describe it. Get to the heart of it. We usually say the soul is two things, the doer and the knower. Because that's what you identify with most of all. I am the one who does, and I am the one who knows. Because you don't think that you are Sri Lankan. It's not a Sri Lankan soul, or sort of, you know, a Canadian soul or a Singaporean soul. You know, that you know enough to know it's nothing to do with the body. So usually we get to these two points, the doer and the knower. And in meditation you go to the point when the doer disappears. And you're still there. So this will can't be anything to do with the soul. Because you've seen it vanish. But then you see the knower vanish. And then you realize, that can't be you either. You see the emptiness of the core of all things. You see non-self. However, you can only, sometimes people argue this with me, well, I argue back, I can't see how anyone can get to the heart of non-self and experience it and know it as a truth, except through the jhanas. Simply because without those you don't have the data. When you get those jhanas, you have the data, the experience, which blows away all those assumptions that you are a soul. That's why in the jhanas, that's what the Buddha did. And after you come out afterwards, you see what the heck was that? Many things were missing. The most obvious thing which was missing was you. And that really starts to see all those things you took as yourself. I can't do that anymore. So you see the illusion of a soul. If you do that, you're called a stream winner. And you're bound for enlightenment. You really are on the bus. And nothing will stop you. You don't want it. What's the big point? You know there's nothing exists. So what's wrong with disappearing? Sooner the better. Wasn't here to begin with. So what have I got to lose? Nothing. Yes. Yeah. Oh, the reason for the whole show here.
But why is it all set up? I mean, I understand, okay, there is no soul somewhere.
Yeah.
But why is it all set up then?
Well, it's because of stupidity. Because of stupidity, sort of people crave for existence, because of the craving for existence which people have, therefore we keep creating more existence. So we're almost like born in stupidity. So where do things start from? Now this is our question about where does God start from? And so you can't have a rational beginning of anything. Because if there was a beginning, what caused the beginning? What was before the beginning? So people who think that they have to have a beginning of things, they've just got, say, a paucity of imagination. It's a obvious, rational dead end. Think, where do things begin from? Instead of beginnings, this is actually saying straight with the Buddha, if you try and find the beginning of things, it just drives you crazy because it's endless. And it cannot have a beginning. If it had a beginning, what was before the beginning? If everything was caused, well, cause the beginning. It's one of these logical, even Bertrand Russell saw through that and said, look, it can't start from a beginning. That's impossible. And what the Buddha said instead of looking at sort of the beginning, a long time in the past, we can see the cause and effect causing, we can see the process. And the process is something which you can see right now and you can identify. The process of life, the process of craving, the process of evolving. And because you can see that process, you can see what keeps it going on. Where it came from, you can't see that. Not because you haven't got enough imagination or you haven't got enough psychic powers or enough memory. Because there's something fundamental there that it cannot have a beginning. But it can have an end. A thing without a beginning which has an ending. Why not? We just have to bend our imagination. This is one of the nicest things, maybe the only thing which I learned from quantum physics, or you know, all this amazing weird stuff in science, was that so often the reason I thought it was weird was because nothing wrong with the truths. The truths were very, very solid. Evidence-based, very firm. It was just the way I looked at life. It was my conceptual framework needed to be expanded. And that's what I learned, how to expand my conceptual frameworks to fit with reality, rather than taking reality and trying to bend that to my pre-existing concepts. This is why, you know, people used to think, you know, this world was flat. It was obvious to them. He's trying to say, no, it's round. It's bent. They said, no way. But eventually the evidence built up, and yes, you could see, yeah, it was round. And then you get Einstein came along and said, no, not round, it's actually curved. The whole universe is curved. Whichever way you point, this is what we used to do in Thailand. I caught some of these monks because we were in a village and the villagers would say, what country do you come from? We say, I come from England. Where's that? And so, you know, we point west. So it's over there. And then somebody else would
say, oh no, but England's also this way as well. And they point south. And they point this way because, you know, the world is round. So, you know, whichever way you can go to England, many ways from Thailand. And obviously there's a short way and a long way. And that, you know, the Thais got really confused. What do you mean it's this way and that way and all over the place? And just these, you know, Americans were being clever. So I decided to out-clever them and said, yeah, but England's also that way and all over the place. Because the universe is curved. So whichever way you go in this universe, in a straight line, you'll come back to where you started, eventually. Because this whole universe is curved, curved space-time. So this universe, this is general theory of relativity, this universe is finite. It's only got a certain space. But there's no edge to it. How can it be finite but there's no edge? And that's true. When you understand sort of general theory of relativity and the curvature of space-time, it is like a ball. No, like a ball, like a football. It's a certain area, but it's got no edge to it. And if you expand that to another dimension, this universe has got a certain volume. It's got no edge at all. It curves back on itself. Now, I'm just bending your conceptions, your perceptions rather. Your framework has to adjust to that reality. And now I'm asking you to bend your framework of beginnings and ends as well. And ask you the question, why not? And the evidence supports what I suggest. That's the great thing about Buddhism. You know, you don't fix your views, but you allow them to expand to fit reality. As you gather more evidence, you have to jettison even some of your basic conceptual frameworks of who you are, or the nature of the will, and freedom, and happiness. You change as the evidence mounts. And sometimes, even scientists, they keep refusing. There's this famous picture of Einstein and Niels Bohr arguing about quantum physics. With, you know, Einstein famously quoted as, God doesn't play dice. And Einstein was wrong. Bohr was right. And quantum physics is one of the great success stories of science. The evidence keeps on piling up and piling up. It works. So even Einstein was bigoted and would not accept what was challenging to his own framework. We always have to keep on jettisoning old ways of looking at things as the evidence builds up. As each one of you will have to jettison your ideas of who you are and the nature of this life. As the evidence based on deep meditation continues to mount and mount and mount until you see how the Buddha saw. Did the Buddha describe the Big Bang? And the answer is no. But he did describe many, many different universes. And he did use the words evolving and devolving. So there's many things he said, but he never specifically mentioned the Big Bang. Yeah, well, it was a sutta, it was just in the text, and it was just explaining it in the terms which people understood it at the time. But even if it was said by the Buddha, if it doesn't make sense, you have to jettison it. Because that's also what the Buddha said. So keep that part which is evidence-based, which accords to your understanding, your experience, especially based on meditation. And you know where that comes from. It's called Kalama Sutta. So, we'll see where the endings are. But for now, you can end. And you can go into the great black hole of your bed. And you can disappear into the great void of unconsciousness. And I'm sure you'll be reincarnated in the morning, either at 4 o'clock, at 5 o'clock, certainly at 7 o'clock for breakfast. The universe is round. It's circular and curved as you go from breakfast to dinner or lunch and then back round again to another day of meditation. So don't bend your mind too much on these things. I answered that because it was a question. But if you really want to find out what the soul is, tomorrow we're going to talk about enlightenment and the end of you. So if you're afraid about the end of you, please have a sleep in and don't get up until 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Because tomorrow you will find out who you really are. Until then, sweet dreams. It might be your last. Okay, go to bed. It's always 10 o'clock. Yeah, it is 10 o'clock. Wow, double time. I should get overtime for tonight.